Well, ladies and gentlemen, I'm Alfred Addisk, and this is Financial Survival for Wednesday night, 8th day of February, year of our Lord, 2017. Our guest is James Corbett. He'll be joining us in just a couple of minutes. I'm going to read the market reports for today, and then James should be joining us in just a couple of more moments. James Corbett from thecorbettreport.com, and he'll be calling in from Japan. Market went up. Gold went up $7.60 today and closed at $1,242 per ounce. Silver's up 8 cents to $17.85 an ounce. Platinum's up 12 bucks to 1,020. Palladium is up 6 to 773. Where are we? U.S. dollar index up 0.14. to 100.33. All right, they seem to be holding lately. The U.S. dollar index seems to be holding right around 100. I don't know if that's just an accident or, you know, an anomaly, or if someone's making it happen that way. But it's not going up and it's not going down too much either. So we'll watch and see what happens. Crude oil is up 15 cents to $52.49 per barrel. Dow Jones average is down 36 to 20,054. NASDAQ is up 8 to 5,682. New York Stock Exchange is up 8 to 11,252. Standard & Poor's is up 1.5 points to 2,295. That's the market report for the day. The big problem, I guess, is that U.S. dollar index. I won't say it's a problem, but it's a curiosity. Gold has been rising steadily for the last week or two, and it's been doing that despite the fact that the equities markets are at record highs, and we have to wonder why is that happening. And our guest, James Corbett, is here. He's online right now. James, are you there?
I am now.
This is James Corbett from thecorbettreport.com. James is calling in from Japan, and you can visit the Corbett Report for some of the best interviews, podcasts, documents that you're likely to find on the internet on politics, economics, geopolitics. What else do you cover, James?
Oh, just about everything except sports, weather, and fashion.
Then how can you attract people on the internet if you're not going to no gossip?
I tend to stay away from it if possible, but yeah, maybe we can add a section if you want.
You should add it. Expand your horizons a little bit. Do a little gossip and make it a little more user friendly for the vast majority of people on the internet. Where are we going? What are we going to talk about this evening, James? I'm a little bit messed up because I have one computer's down completely, another one's not working right, can't get my script lined up today. We're going to wind up flying by the seat of the pants here. But let's talk about Donald Trump for a moment. There have been allegations that some of his documents or his intentions and plans have been leaked by people who should be loyal to him. There's kind of an odd assortment of cabinet officers, and some people are having concerns about them. Is Trump dangerous, or has Trump become something of a laughingstock?
Potentially both. I think there are other elements to this as well, but as you point out, there does seem to be, as I'm sure there is in every administration, but it's particularly coming to the forefront in this one, that there are different people in there with their own ideas and agendas, and who may dissent very much from what is coming out of the White House itself, including U.S. Supreme Court nominee Neil Gorsuch, of course, just nominated by Trump. His latest comments, he's come out and said that it's disheartening and demoralizing to hear Trump talking the way he has been talking in recent days about the judiciary and the way that his court case is going with regards to the executive order on immigration. So I think there's a lot of people with a lot of room to be discontent or unhappy with what's going on right now, and that's coming to the surface. And I've been following an account on Twitter that's, if not, I mean, is at least entertaining. I can't verify for its veracity, but it claims to be someone on the inside of the White House who is going under the name Rogue POTUS on Twitter and is tweeting out information about the deliberations that are taking place behind closed doors between Trump and his main advisors. Again, I can't verify the veracity of it, but it's certainly interesting to see, and I think we're going to see a lot of that coming out in this administration specifically, where when you have so much controversial, so many controversial things taking place, I think you're going to see the leaks and things coming out more fast and furious, to coin a phrase, than we saw in previous administrations.
I don't think Trump's the kind of man who will put up with disloyalty. I think he demands loyalty, and he expects loyalty. And from what I understand, he tends to be loyal to his own employees and his private businesses and the rest of that. The idea that somebody is leaking information, that has to make him, I'm going to assume that makes him just extraordinarily angry.
One would certainly imagine so, but I think if he wasn't aware of it before, he's going to be finding out the difference between running a company and running a federal government with millions of employees, quote-unquote. So I think that's going to make itself felt, and obviously there are different people with different seats of power that are going to make their own agendas felt, whether he likes it or not. So I think maybe he's coming to that understanding that sometimes, as you paraphrased in that Bill Hicks joke about the incoming president getting this special screening from certain high-ranking bankers and businessmen when he comes into office, the special view of the Kennedy assassination from a vantage point no one's ever seen before, and afterwards they simply ask any questions, and he says, "No, what's my agenda?" I think there may be a version of that playing out right now, and it's certainly questionable to me to the extent that Trump is going to be the overlord who is really making the decisions or calling the shots in this government.
I think I can remember Bill Clinton when he became president. He made a comment, "You work all your life in politics to get into the position of the presidency, and you get there and you find out that somebody else is pulling your strings." He said words to that effect, and you probably remember the quote.
I can't remember it off the top of my head, but there's also that old joke about David Rockefeller. "Mr. Rockefeller, why didn't you become president?" And he said, "I didn't want to take a demotion." And there is definitely something to that.
I understand. What do we think about George Soros? There's a report that Trump has declared him an enemy of the United States. I can't think of the exact term, but he has warned that Trump that Soros has caused a great deal of trouble and that he's going to be held accountable for it. Do you think the reports are valid, and do you think that they're justified?
Well, there's certainly no love lost between these two, and I don't know the quote that you're referring to, but I did see that just last month George Soros called Trump a would-be dictator who is going to fail. And, of course, Soros has been tied to so many of the different protest movements that have sprung up in recent years. Of course, we know his involvement in the various color revolutions in various parts of the world. He's quite infamous for that, including, of course, his connections to Ukraine, which came out in that recently released 60 Minutes video that was an interview of him that was done in the 1990s, where at that time he was talking about pumping money in to fund Ukrainian forces, which certainly did come into play during the Maidan Revolution. But at any rate, it certainly seems there's some sort of American spring, or whatever it's being called, that's in the offing, and Soros has been tied to some of the recent Trump protest activity. So
not just protests, but violence.
Absolutely, yes, of course. Yeah. I guess protest is now a shorthand for violence. Unfortunately, that is what people think when you talk about protest movements. You think of black-clad people going around smashing windows and setting garbage cans on fire and what have you. And that really is the way that most people see these protests from the outside at this point, because of course that's what gets all the media coverage. And all it takes is a couple of people dressed all in black clothes who you can't see and you don't know who they are, and they just come and they destroy things and start the fires and get things going and leave. I mean, it's clearly provocateur, and it doesn't take a great degree of organization or ability to be able to do that and disrupt valid protest movements with violence. And unfortunately, that seems to be the way things are going more and more frequently these days.
During the 1960s, we had a great deal of protest and violence based on the Vietnam War. I don't think you remember that. I don't think you were old enough to remember it. Is that true?
I would have been negative several years old, yeah.
Okay. Still, it was motivated, that those protests were ultimately motivated by the Vietnam War and the draft, and people did not want to go and die in a jungle, or at least some people didn't want to, and so they said, to heck with that, we don't want to protest. Is the economic stress that we're seeing in our society right now, does that parallel what we saw in the 1960s, in a sense that the economic stress is comparable to the political stress that we saw back in the 1960s, and therefore people are more prone to demonstrate?
I think certainly economic stress is one of the factors that goes into the widespread discontent that we've seen, and I think that one of the offshoots of that was the 2016 presidential race, where someone like Trump or someone like Bernie Sanders or people who are completely not at all within that in that very narrow spectrum of allowable opinion that we've seen in every other presidential race in modern history. I think that is one of the manifestations of the deep economic pain that people have been feeling and desperately looking for something different. Another way that manifests is, of course, in protests. And I think the people who have felt they've been politically disenfranchised because they didn't think Trump would be their economic savior are taking it out in other ways. And so, I mean, when we talk about someone like a Soros or other people like that who are funding and creating these provocateur protests behind the scenes, we have to understand there are many, many, many people who are genuinely, organically, and spontaneously participating in these movements as well. There has to be that base of discontent for this type of action to have any real substance. And we saw that in the Arab Spring and elsewhere. To the extent that they were manipulated by outside forces, it was also a reflection of deep discontent within the public. So I think that has to be there as a baseline. And I think probably the key factor in this is the economic pain that many people have been feeling, at least since the 2008 collapse and the so-called recovery that very few people have really experienced at the bottom rung of the economic ladder.
I think it's a good point that you make about the Arab Spring. Because does the Arab Spring, is it a manifestation of the same thing we're seeing in Brexit? And the same thing we're seeing with Trump's election? And the same thing we're seeing with people that are perhaps going to bail out of the European Union? Is the whole world becoming increasingly unstable? The Middle East and Europe, the United States, and we are closing our doors, becoming more paranoid perhaps, but is it, what's motivating it? What's causing what seems to be maybe a global phenomena?
It's a good question. I'm not sure there is any one answer that will completely answer that question, because so many of these factors play into each other and feed off of each other. But clearly we are in an era of destabilization of so many different norms and things that we've seen. And Trump is obviously a lightning rod for those types of moves. And we see so many things that are coming out now that are just would have been unthinkable in any other, you know, presidency that we've seen in our lifetimes. Even destabilization of relationships like the Australian-American relationship, where Australia has been a staunch supporter of anything and everything that America has been involved in, militarily and otherwise, over the last half century. And now seeing even that being called into question and acrimonious relations, things like that that have just would have been unthinkable. So clearly we're in an era of destabilization. The question of what is causing that, I think there are a number of different factors, but one that cannot be overlooked is the media itself and the creation of the perception of chaos, disorder, things falling apart. I think that feeds into a perception then amongst the public that things are chaotic and disorderly and nothing makes any sense, and then that gets manifested in reality. And there was a really good video recently by Truthstream Media on YouTube. I hope people will look it up. I can't remember the title of the video, but it's their most recent one, where they were talking, they just compiled a bunch of different clips just from the last couple of months of the media, mainstream talking heads talking about chaos, chaotic, it's going crazy, it's chaos. And just compiling all of those clips really does give you the sense that people are at the very least being programmed to experience what we are living through as chaos. And I think that feeds into it. To whatever extent they are reporting on genuine phenomena that are taking place, I think they're also bringing it about. It's like the observation that the reporting on school shootings causes more school shootings. I think that's kind of the phenomenon that we're seeing happening right now. So I think it's being amplified by the media, especially, of course, the establishment fake news media. So the question is, why is that being pushed, and to what extent are people being manipulated into basically getting at each other's throats more and more right now? I see such a deep divide right now between left and right and every other conceivable differentiation amongst the public right now. I think it's going to play out in ways that we can dimly comprehend at the moment, but ways that do not look pretty from where we're sitting right now.
Well, the media is fanning the flames, but are the flames being fanned for a political reason, because they want political instability? And they think that they are not for the sake of the media per se, but for the sake of whoever owns the media, whoever controls media. Are they trying to cause political instability, or is it just a question of whatever bleeds leads? And people are more interested; they'll pay more attention if you've got something violent and hyper that you can send you, that you can sell them as part of your media package. Is it just a way of advertising? We've got more violence than the next guy.
Yeah. Well, I mean, those two ideas aren't mutually exclusive. I think clearly it does help their bottom line to hype things up and to become hyperpartisan. And the Washington Post has certainly made use over the last few months of its position of floating the most ridiculous conspiracy theories about Russia and what have you. Even though those stories continue to be retracted and amended, they continue to push them because they do generate clicks, which does generate advertising revenue. So there is definitely an economic incentive. But on the broader scale, I think there really is a concerted attempt to foster a type of political and social, I don't know if collapse is the right word, but I think something along those lines. I think we're seeing that happening right now. And ultimately, I'm wary of making world historical conclusions about the times we're living through, but honestly, I would not be surprised if historians of a future generation do see this as, you know, the end of Pax Americana, the end of the American Empire, the end of the post-World War II era of international order. It really is coming to a head right now, and that takes place monetarily and financially and economically and socially and politically all at the same time, and it looks quite chaotic when it happens.
Let's take a break for a couple of commercials, and we will be back on Financial Survival with our guest James Corbett from thecorbettreport.com. Please stay tuned, and a couple of minutes, we'll be right back.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it: to secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. Invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSETalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading 1-800-375-4188 or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
Hi, folks. I'm Alfred Addisk, and this is Financial Survival. Our guest is James Corbett from the CorbettReport.com, C-O-R-B-E-T-T, for some of the best videos, podcasts, articles, thinking on economics, geopolitics. But as James says, there's no gossip, there's no fashion, and there's no sports. So if you're looking for those three subjects, that Corbett Report won't probably be your best choice. But if you're trying to understand what's happening in the world right now, one of the best places you can visit is thecorbettreport.com. Hello, James.
Hello. Hello again.
Yep. Hello again. We're talking about Donald Trump a little bit. There was a report in one of the newspapers that last night, Donald Trump asked his national security advisor, Michael Flynn, at 3 a.m. in the morning. He allegedly called at 3 a.m. in the morning to ask him whether the economy was better off with a strong dollar or a weak dollar. Now, all by itself, that question, if this is a true story, and who can say anymore, but it appears to me to be a valid story. If it is, it indicates that Trump is having second thoughts about his notion that the dollar is too strong and it needs to be weakened. What do you think is best for the U.S. economy? A strong dollar? A weak dollar? Are either one of those selections a good selection?
Right. Well, I think the fundamental question is who should be deciding that and in what way should that be decided? I mean, do we need a government to set a dollar policy? Do we need a central bank that will, in the case of the Federal Reserve, pump in trillions of liquidity and or take it out of the system as they feel is needed in order to keep inflation at a certain rate or to keep unemployment at a certain rate? Who should be managing the economy, I think, is the fundamental question. And I think the real answer is no one. I think there should be free markets. But in the case of that we have, where the U.S. government obviously does think of itself as the manager of the economy, and here is a man who quite obviously thinks of himself as a businessman who can control every aspect of his business. I'm sure that's the way that he's looking to try to run the U.S. economy. And so the question is, strong dollar or weak dollar? Of course, both have their pluses and minuses. It depends what kind of economy you're looking to have and what role you are looking to take in the international monetary order. Given that you have the U.S. dollar as the world reserve currency, and given that there will never, within this time period, within this era, within this context and this system of the U.S. dollar as the world reserve currency, you will never have a lack of demand for U.S. dollars, then the answer would seem to be, well, print as many as you need. It doesn't really matter to what extent you run the U.S. dollar down. There will still be people who will be eager to take U.S. debt. And to the extent that the U.S. dollar is inflated away, well, that gives you an export advantage for export products. But the question is, what is America exporting these days? That's a very good question. Now, if Trump is trying to turn the economy around and make it into a domestic production-based economy for domestic consumption, then the question of strong and weak dollar does not, at least in that economic sense, does not have as big a deal, is not as big a problem. Then it becomes more a question of, well, okay, so what raw materials are you importing and from where? And if you have a strong dollar, you can import them more cheaply. And you don't have to worry so much about export markets. So there's a lot of considerations that would go in, but then of course there's also the geopolitical and monetary aspects to this, which have, I won't say have nothing to do, but are tangential to the economic issues and what that means for the average person in working in the economy.
Well, when we talk about lack of demand for U.S. dollars, what does that compare? How does that relate to the push that seems to be building in the world for a cashless society? Can the dollar we've had, I think it was Larry Summers, former Secretary of the Treasury, I think he was advocating back 6 weeks ago, he said, we need to get rid of the $100 bill. What happens to all the $100 bills that are tucked away in people's mattresses in India and Africa? I mean, their $100 bill has been their form of savings in much of the world. If we get rid of the $100 bill, what happens to it? Do they become worthless? And is that tolerable? And can the dollar remain as the world reserve currency if it cancels its $100 bills?
Yes, this is an interesting question. I think it would still, but it would certainly change that dynamic. And as you say, the vast majority of specifically $100 currency units are kept overseas, are not domestic. So it is forms of savings in a lot of different countries that do not have that perception of stability in their own currencies. So that would have a significant effect. It depends, I suppose, how that is done, how it is phased out. If it's demonetized all at once, and I mean, I couldn't imagine that they would say those are just simply not valid anymore. I mean, there would be a period whereby you would be able to exchange them for, you know, valid currency. So it's a question of what access, you know, people in rural India, for example, would have to that mechanism. And if they don't have direct access to it, then I'm sure a black market would develop for them to offload the bills at a premium in order to get something out of them. But it would cause some disruption that way for sure. And it would, I think, have an effect on the extent to which the world perceived the U.S. dollar, at the U.S. currency, as the kind of world, the world bedrock. You don't want to be rocking the boat too much when you're the boat that sets the tide for everyone else. That's a strained analogy, but you get what I'm saying. I mean, to be the world reserve currency, you have to project that stability, and to be demonetizing base currency notes is kind of a dramatic move. But one could see it certainly happening, and obviously there are already floating ideas about this in Europe and elsewhere about the 500 euro note and what have you. So we're going to see it happening.
India's wiped out their two largest notes. I think it was 1,000 rupees and 500 rupees. Pardon me?
They replaced them with new notes. So
have they replaced them already? They didn't initially. It was promised, and I don't know whether they are actually replacing them now or not, but it was promised they'd be replaced, but it didn't seem to happen, at least in short order.
Well, it was the typical Indian bureaucratic nightmare where the printers had been assured that they had until the end of the year to get the new notes ready. But then suddenly Prime Minister Modi announced it on live TV in November, and suddenly they were a couple of months short of the goal. And so there was a huge confusion and headache, and they've been scrambling to print. And I just saw that they're going to be allowing, I think, 50,000 rupees of withdrawals in the new currency per week, I believe, from February 20th, and then no restrictions from March 13th or something like that. So they're still scrambling to keep up. But one would imagine that within the coming months, they will have that finally sorted, and the new bills will be there to replace what was taken out.
What was the purpose of replacing the existing bills, the ones that had been there, if they're just going to replace them with new bills? I mean, I can understand the purpose if they were going to replace the existing bills and they were going to replace them with plastic debit cards, credit cards, whatever, but some sort of plastic currency where you can swipe your little plastic card and then you get your whatever it is you're trying to purchase. But
right.
What's the purpose of changing, getting rid of these bills and putting in new paper bills?
Well, a couple of weeks ago, I talked to Satya Sagar, a commentator from India, who has a few articles up on this that I'll direct your listeners to. They can go watch my interview or they can read his own articles, including one called Death by Demonetization that was posted up at kafila.online back in November. And he pointed out at least four different reasons that this would be beneficial to Modi and the Indian government. The first would be to basically recapitalize Indian banks. All of this paper cash that was sitting out there, stuffed under mattresses and what have you, you know, hiding from the tax man, will be, as a result of this, have been flowing through the banks to get the new notes. And a lot of that ends up getting parked in banks because now that it's declared, there's no point in hiding it under your mattress so much. So it has helped to recapitalize Indian banks. It has increased the government's cash flow because a significant portion of the cash being held has been this so-called black money. This is a term they use in India to talk about money that is not taxed, that is outside of the system. Well, obviously, having to declare it as they turn in their old notes and get new notes means a flush of new tax revenue for the Indian government. It's also, there's a political agenda to this as well, because a lot of that black money that's being kept outside of the purview of the government is used in a lot of political campaigns. So the funding, this could be a key way to cut off that black money funding for the political opponents of Narendra Modi and the current government. But perhaps most interestingly, the idea that has been talked about of India going cashless. And this is tied into that in a number of different ways. One of them was pointed out by a German analyst called Norbert Herring, who had an article a couple of months ago about this, where he was talking about how U.S. aid had helped to sponsor a program called Catalyst, Inclusive Cashless Payment Partnership, talking about how they were going to boost the cashless payment system infrastructure in India. And that was launched 4 weeks before the demonetization took place.
Do you think Modi did a good job? It came off as it seemed to be botched so badly you had to suppose that it was just an idiotic idea to begin with. Do you think it's going to turn out in retrospect that India has done a pretty good job of replacing existing currencies with a new and improved currency that is not... It's apparently allergic to mattresses. You can't stuff mattresses with a new currency. They make it with fiberglass so it itches, perhaps. I'm not sure, but is this a good, is it going to turn out well for India, or is this a botched idea?
Well, I guess there's a few different ways you could measure that. I mean, is this going to turn out well politically for Modi? That's a good question. I think it was deeply unpopular at the time, but depending on how the perception of all of this is manipulated, people might think, oh, you know, everything's better now that that black money has been taken care of, and now the Indian government has more money to play with. So it could theoretically turn into a political positive for him, but either way, he had quite a bit of political capital to spend, as it were, and I think he might have just spent it there. So the question is, does he get what he wants out of this? More broadly, is this good for India? I think ultimately this is really about fostering that cashless payments system infrastructure in India, where we've seen, as a direct result of this, cashless payment systems, mobile payment firms, Paytm and other companies like that have seen huge boosts in customers since this demonetization. Again, people who were keeping cash out of the system and now are forced to declare it, well, they might as well just hop on the new cashless payment systems, and that's even easier, especially when there's that liquidity crunch caused by the fact there aren't enough bills of these new bills to go around. So everyone's hopping on to these cashless payment systems. I think that ultimately that's going to give a lot more people access to the banking system. People even in rural India who wouldn't necessarily have a bank account, but now actually can transact through their smartphones and other things that increasingly a larger percentage of the population actually does have access to. But with that, of course, comes the biometric ID control grid, which is a very much a part of this. In fact, just in the last couple of weeks, the Indian government has announced they're going to be launching a new feature to the smart ID cards that they've been handing out over the last few years, where they've been trying to put 1.1 billion people into their biometric ID system, scanning their fingerprints and their irises. They've just announced they're going to be linking that up to a payment system. So soon you'll be able to just swipe your finger to pay for this or that. And I think we know where that's going. And I think ultimately it's the perfect panopticon where the government will see every transaction that takes place in the economy.
And you'll be taxed on everything you do as soon as you do it. And you'll probably be taxed on everything you save. If you don't spend it, you'll be taxed on your savings. And if you do spend it, you'll be taxed on your spending. The government is out there to get as much as it possibly can. But the one thing you can say about this is apparently Modi has succeeded in pulling this currency that had been squirreled away and put it back into the economy. And that should have increased the money supply, and that should have stimulated India's economy to some measurable degree. And it may be that the people are saying, hey, this is working for me. I'm making more than I was, so I'm pretty pleased with Mr. Modi. You suppose that's true?
It could be, and there's a logic to that, but the facts don't necessarily go in line with that, in fact, because of the economic disruption caused by the taking out of these notes and the fact that there was so few people who were able to get access to actual cash during this period. Mm-hmm. The Tamil Nadu governor actually came out recently to say that this has actually decreased tax revenue because there's less economic activity going on because everyone's just trying to scramble to do any sort of economic transactions, despite the fact they don't have this new cash. So at least in the short term, it's actually decreased tax revenue, at least for certain parts of India. And so it's not necessarily all as peachy sunshine and rainbows as the Indian government would like, which leads me to believe this is even more so about that biometric ID cashless payment system than it is about the tax revenue itself.
You're living in the south western portion of Japan, isn't that true?
Yes, to the extent that south and north and west and east have, I mean, it's a small country, but yes, on the western side of the main island, yeah.
Well, the reason I'm asking is because Fukushima, as I understand it, is in the northeast. And there's a report that Fukushima is becoming more dangerous right now. Is that report exaggerated, or are we going to see even more radioactive waste pouring into the Pacific Ocean? And we've got about a minute till we take a break here.
All right. Well, in a minute or less, to answer your question, Fukushima is about 400 miles away from where I'm living. And what has just been found is that inside the reactor number one, we've seen the highest radiation reading since the whole meltdown scenario started. And this has been determined by examining video from inside the reactor and looking at the radiation exposure that the video has been subject to. They found 530 sieverts of radiation. Just to put that in perspective, that would kill any human being within a matter of seconds or minutes. It's an extremely high level of radiation, and they don't know precisely why it's gotten to that point right now.
Oh, that's good news. We have a problem, but we don't even know why. How are we going to fix a problem that we don't understand? We'll talk about that when we return to Financial Survival in just a moment. A couple of commercials, and I'll be back with my guest, James Corbett from thecorbettreport.com.
Every heart is Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
We all know that Berkey Water Purification Systems are the most trusted name in water filtration. As an authorized Berkey dealer for over 6 years and serving thousands of satisfied customers, the Berkey Guy offers amazing specials for Berkey Water Filtration Systems. The Berkey Light Systems include a set of self-sterilizing and recleanable black purification elements that purify water by removing chlorine, pathogenic bacteria, cysts, and parasites to non-detectable levels and remove harmful chemicals such as herbicides and pesticides. Order the Berkey Light System today, complete with two black Berkey elements for only $231, and the Berkey Guy will ship your order free of charge. With the purchase of a Berkey Light, the Berkey Guy is also offering a set of fluoride and arsenic filters for only $39.99. That's over 30% off the retail price. Call the Berkey Guy at 1-877-886-3653. That's 1-877-886-3653. Or order online at GoBerkey.com. That's GoBerkey.com today.
Hi, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Alfred Adusk here with my guest, James Corbett from the CorbettReport.com, C-O-R-B-E-T-T, report.com. We're talking about Fukushima and apparently an increase in radiation for reasons that we don't understand. Does anyone have any understanding of how much it might increase?
Well, it's not necessarily an increase. It's just the first time they've detected this particular radiation reading level. And basically the story, as reported by Kyodo, is that they took images of a remote through a remote-controlled camera, and they found a 2-meter hole in the metal grating under the pressure vessel that is in the reactor's primary containment vessel. And so that hole may or may not be where some of the actual core material melted through. They still don't know precisely where the core material is lying, but it could certainly be that they are now detecting actual core material itself, and that could explain the 530 sieverts. Within a functioning nuclear reactor, you would see several thousand sieverts per hour of radioactivity, so it certainly could be an indication that they're finding the fuel itself. And so it wouldn't be necessarily surprising if that's what that is. But again, this is inside the reactor itself. So they're still exploring, you know, with an aim to ultimately removing the fuel and making everything better again. But I think they're very much a long way off from that. And things like this, where they suddenly discover hundreds of sieverts per hour, it's certainly puts hampers in that effort, because obviously no human could come anywhere near that.
What about robots? I've heard that you made the comment that 500 or more, 500 sieverts or more would be enough to kill man, woman in just a matter of minutes, if I understood you correctly. But one of the big surprises is that the robots, they send in mechanical devices to take a look and see what's going on, and they are also crippled. Turns out that their circuitry is subject to degradation by radiation. So what about the robots? Are they able to go in there and explore?
They do have robots that are capable of withstanding exposure of up to 1,000 sieverts. So they estimate that if this is 530 sieverts, and the method that they're using to estimate that radiation level, it's not a direct detection. Again, this is from digital interference on the camera itself. So there's a plus minus 30% margin of error in that reading. So it could be down more like 400, it could be upwards of 600. But anyway, in that range, they would expect the robot to be able to withstand at least 2 hours operating in that environment. So they are going to be sending more robots in to, or a new robot in to try to see if they can probe this in greater detail. But it will not last very long. A couple of hours of activity is all they'll be able to get out of it.
Speaking of robots, I saw a report in the newspaper today, or one of the news media, one of the news outlets, that a factory in China has replaced much of its employees with robots, and they're able to use 90% less people. And the result has been an increase in productivity of 250% and 80% less defects in their product. Now, when you see those kinds of numbers, is there anything that can withstand the economic imperative to install more robots? They've got to be less expensive, and they make a better product. Is there any way that this can be resisted? Should it be resisted? And what are we going to do if we don't resist it?
And let me tell you an interesting story that might seem unrelated, but I'm reading right now a ridiculously voluminous biography of the Beatles. It was written by Mark Lewisohn, who is considered the foremost historian of the Beatles in the world, and he's writing a 3-volume biography of them right now, and he's in the midst of it. He's been writing it for
years. Rise and Fall of the Beatles is
pretty
much
what
we have here.
Uh-huh. Yes, and so the first volume has been released, and the first volume covers up until the end of 1962, so before Beatlemania even takes place. The trade version of that is an 800-page volume, but I have the extended special edition that is 1,700 pages. So it covers basically the mid-1950s up until 1962. But the beauty of this biography is that it is telling the story in the context of the world they were living in and what was happening at that time. And one of the things that was in there recently that really stuck out to me was, at one point, Paul McCartney was he was doing a day job as a manual laborer at a coil winding facility, and when it was still up in the air whether or not he would, you know, commit full time to the Beatles. Obviously, we know which way he ended up going, but it was talking about the economic conditions at factories like that, and basically the stagnation of British industry because of the labor's intransigence at the idea of automation or anything that would decrease the amount of manual labor that was required, and of course would mean layoffs for people. And it is the conundrum, because obviously there is no doubt, no one can deny that factories will be more efficient and thus create greater profit and more money for the owners of the factories, for sure, with automation. And yet, you cannot dispute that there will be real economic hardship for the people who fall through those cracks, the people who get laid off as a result of that. Now, you can, as a society, as England did to a large extent in the mid-20th century, try to forestall that, and you can have extremely strong labor organizations that basically go on strike at the drop of a hat and stop that progress from happening. But all that means is that country, yes, sure, England might forestall the inevitable, but other countries will absolutely allow themselves to go through that process, will break the strikes, will break up the labor organizations, will go ahead with the automation. The only question is where it will take place. And in an increasingly globalized world with global supply chains, do you think factory workers care, factory owners at all care where they source their goods from? Whether they have to build their factory in China or Malaysia or wherever, whatever country offers the best general framework for their laws will be the one that they go to. So, for example, when it comes to Trump and protectionist policies in America and what they're going to do to stop this type of, you know, replacement of human workers, it will be done elsewhere in the world. And where it is done elsewhere will receive the economic benefits that redound to those who are willing to go for the automation at whatever expense, social and otherwise. I think it's inevitable, and I think it's we're already seeing it, and I don't think there's a way to put brakes on this process.
I don't think there's a way to put brakes on it either, especially we're talking about this report I mentioned. This is China. We're not talking about a place that's overrun by high wages. These people are already working for minimum wage to begin with, and yet 90% of them are being replaced in this one factory with an increase of 250% productivity and 80% less defects. Now, this is not just a curiosity. This is something, if you're running a factory selling widgets and I'm running a factory selling widgets and you install robots in yours, you have such a competitive advantage. There is no option for me other than to install my own set of robots. I can't continue to work with people if you're using robots. And again, this is China. If they can get rid of 90% of labor in China, it seems obvious to me that they can get rid of 90% or more labor in the United States or Great Britain and so on. This is a revolution, and it's moving so quickly. I mean, economic imperatives are so enormous that you must move or you're going to be out. You're going to be done. Take your factory and shut the doors. Sell the bricks. You know, hire labor to chip the concrete off the bricks or the cement off the bricks, and maybe you can sell the bricks and capture a little money for your plant, but that will be the end of it. This isn't a process. How long do you think it's going to take before the public is seriously aware of the threat that robots pose? And when I say threat, means you're not going to have a job. Maybe you will, but the average man will not have a job. He may have a welfare system that's going to support him, and he can kick back and just play on his Xbox all day. But will that generate psychological hardships? You mentioned economic hardships. What about psychological hardships? Can man get by without working?
Well, it's going to be interesting to find out, because I think we are going to find out inevitably.
Yeah, no.
And just as context, I did say at the end of every year, myself and James Evan Pilato, we do a weekly news show called New World Next Week. At the end of each year, we pick a trend for the coming year that we think will define the trend of the year. And for 2017, I picked the trend of the rise of the robots. I really do think this is going to be increasingly something that comes to the forefront of political attention and the attention of the sort of average workers out there as we start to see more stories like this one. I'm not sure it's necessarily this year that everything is going to come to a head, but in the coming years, there's going to have to be some serious societal discussion of this issue, where it's only been sort of gestured at up to this point. And that's why you're starting to see the conversation about universal basic income, the idea of governments just paying everyone a certain amount of money every year. And then, you know, if you can make more on top of that, great. If not, it'll be enough for you to live on. It will be very interesting to see who tries to implement that and in what way and what strings come attached to that. But I am extremely dubious that that will provide a different way of organizing the society and the world than we've seen up to this point in a way that will satisfy everyone. And the question, Can people live without work? I don't think so. I mean, it's maybe just a question of what we define work and what will come along to replace that. And to be fair, there are people on the other side that say, oh, we've seen this scare so many times over the past century or two that the end of work as we know it and all of this, and it's never come to pass. I think this is a difference in kind in terms of what we're seeing right now with the automation, but there are people who will say, oh, you know, there will be people to program the robots and that'll be the new jobs and the new economy.
They've already got robots, if I understand correctly, that are writing their own software. Now, I don't know that they're even going to need you or me to program the robots. I think our only option is perhaps we can all become rock stars. I'd get a guitar. Maybe that's where the big money is. Invest in guitars. It will be one of the things that the robots... How long will it be before robots can play the guitars as well as a conventional rock star? Do you have any idea?
Well, there was a story from last year about an AI system that had created a song, or so they said. And when you read into the story, it wasn't... I think they overhyped it and the role of the AI in creating the song. But I think that is coming. I think we do see those types of trends developing. And as you say, it's not just that this is taking place quickly. It's increasingly taking place more and more quickly. The acceleration is accelerating.
That's exactly right.
It is an exponential trend. So the things that are coming, even in the next few years, I think will be quite amazing. And I always like to think back to even 10, 15 years ago. The idea of a smartphone would have almost been a magical, I mean, incredible technology to have that in your
Star
hand.
Wars.
Now we take it. Exactly. Now we take it for granted. Can you imagine what we'll be taking for granted 10 or 15 years from now?
It is unimaginable. Do you know of anyone that you think can accurately imagine what's likely to happen 15 years from now? I mean, to me, it's hard. Can anyone really give us a reliable prediction what's going to happen 5 years from now or 3 years from now? Who knows what Trump is going to do next week?
Right. Well, maybe DARPA will be able to let us in on the technology they have sealed up in the bowels of the Pentagon there, 50 years ahead of anything else we've seen commercially. So I don't know. I mean, I'm sure that things are actually much more developed than what we ultimately get as end users of this technology. So someone knows what we're going to be seeing in a few years, I imagine.
Well, they may have an idea, but this is, again, the difference. You said this is different from, you know, in the past they had sabotage. The world is derived from throwing your sabots, your wooden shoes, into Dutch manufacturing facilities, maybe the 1600s, I don't remember what century, but the people were afraid that they were going to take their jobs, so they threw their shoes in the machinery and jammed up the machines, and they called it sabotage. Back then, yeah, this problem has always been facing us, but never at this velocity. We could adjust. New technology, yeah, it would come. But we had enough time to adjust. I don't think we're going to have time to adjust on this. I don't even think most people are capable of the adjustment. Yeah. This isn't just learning how to use a new backhoe. These are things with software that we aren't going to be able to understand. The average person will not be able to comprehend or deal with. And then what?
And then even if you do adjust, I mean, think of the adjustment that had to take place because of the Industrial Revolution. It made the world from a predominantly rural agrarian society into a predominantly urban society. More people live in cities now than live in rural areas for the first time in human history. The incredible societal and cultural changes that take place as a result of these technological revolutions cannot be underestimated, and one can imagine how much more amplified that process will be as we live through the robot revolution.
Especially with populations as large as they are. That's another part of the equation, but we'll have to leave that for another time because we're out of time. So thanks for being on the program, James. As always, enjoyed talking to you. I'm Alfred Addisk. This is Financial Survival, and I hope you'll tune in tomorrow. In the meantime, the good Lord bless you, me, Melody, Todd the producer, and James Corbett. Bye.
I work all night, I work all day to pay the bills I have to pay. Ain't it sad? And still there never seems to be a single penny left for me. That's too bad.